Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today we'll have analysis for you on what the sale of our region's biggest newspaper could mean for San Diego County readers. We'll have news about water cuts approved by supervisors, wildfire preparations being taken by the county, and a body found in a burned house in Alpine. On Green Scene, learn what new cuts in greenhouse gas emissions could mean for California. Hear about a proposed hike in cigarette taxes, an energy loan program from SDG&E that's benefiting local tribes and governments, a boycott of produce grown just over the border in San Quintin, Mexico, and why Californians are being asked to report roadkill along our highways. I'll have a report also on my trip to Costa Rica and what I learned about rainforests, climate change, and how the U.S. Congress is viewed in Central America. We'll have all the most fun festivals and events coming up on Destination East County. And finally, on Bookshelf, we'll be re-airing our interview with the La Mesa police captain on his book, Bulletproof Spirit. We'll have all these stories and more, so stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. UT San Diego, our region's largest daily newspaper, has announced an agreement to sell to the Chicago-based Tribune Publishing. The fourth-largest newspaper chain in America, Tribune Publishing owns the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, and other major newspapers. The $85 million deal would end local ownership of the 146-year-old UT and the controversial reign of developer Doug Manchester as publisher, opening the door to a potential shift toward higher journalistic standards, some experts say. Manchester acquired the newspaper in 2011, later acquiring a total of 9 local publications ranging from the North County Times to the Ramona Sentinel here in East County, and those are also included in the sale. Manchester drew criticism for injecting political bias into the newsroom as well as using the newspaper to further his own personal financial interests as a developer. When a developer-stacked red tape reduction task force appointed by supervisors sought to eliminate community planning groups countywide, for example, Manchester failed to inform his readers of this. While many newspapers wield influence through editorial pages, Manchester went further, wrapping the front page in editorials for conservative candidates that he favored. After helping elect Republican Mayor Kevin Faulkner with editorials and six-figure personal contributions to his campaign, Manchester succeeded in having his own company architect appointed to the City of San Diego's Planning Commission and got environmental obstacles to his Grand Del Mar Resort lifted. New York Times media columnist David Carr remarked that under Manchester, the UT looked like, quote, a brochure for his various interests, unquote. Sale of the UT will allow Manchester to retain ownership of the UT's property in Mission Valley, which he has indicated he hopes to develop as residential property. The new owners retain a one-year lease and reportedly aim to seek a new headquarters locally for the UT. The new publisher, Austin Buettner, is a former Smith Barney analyst and ex-deputy mayor of economic development appointed by Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa. When Tribune Publishing acquired the Los Angeles Times, Buettner was named publisher of the major L.A. newspaper. Buettner has been an Obama financial backer who has also got ties to Bill and Hillary Clinton, though he has pledged to keep politics out of the newsroom at the UT, which, by the way, may take back its historic Union Tribune name, Buettner has indicated. City News Service reports that Buettner has said the UT will continue to operate as a separate brand with its own newsroom. UT president and editor Jeff Light will retain his post. Buettner says the company can cut costs, combine resources, and share stories, photos, and other content, UT San Diego reports. Buettner told the UT, "That's our competitive advantage. We have more voices and more content, and that's how we win in a digital world. We compete by having the best content." Tribune Publishing has apparently beat out efforts by developer and philanthropist Malin Burnham, who sought to form a community nonprofit to acquire and run the UT. For 81 years, the UT was owned by the Copley family, a conservative powerhouse dynasty in the region. In the 2009 recession following the death of Helen Copley, heir David Copley sold off the newspaper to a private equity firm, Platinum Equity, which turned it over to Manchester just 2 years later. Capital New York writer Ken Doctor calls the rapid turnover, including the latest sale to Tribune Publishing, emblematic of the chaos of American newspapering, which has weathered declining readership coinciding with the rise in Internet news outlets. Dean Nelson, journalism professor at Point Loma Nazarene University, has said he is cautiously optimistic that the sale will lead to improved reporting, calling Manchester's legacy minimal and bordering on harmful. George Mitrovich, City Club of San Diego president, stated that the more enlightened among the town citizenry know the Times is superior to the UT, and if the buyout means better journalism for San Diego, then the new ownership should be welcomed, not scorned. Carl Luna is a political science professor at Mesa College. He has noted that the political views of Manchester were out of step with the city's changing demographics and Democratic voter registration majority. He voiced optimism that a restored San Diego Union Tribune can become a voice which speaks to and for an increasingly diverse and dynamic San Diego, the Los Angeles Times reports. Republican Mayor Kevin Faulkner, however, who benefited from Manchester's editorializing, praised Manchester for an incredible track record and, quote, quality reporting. Democratic Councilman Todd Gloria noted that the Chargers have also been wooed by Los Angeles interests, concluding, "I welcome Los Angeles acquiring our newspaper, but not our football team." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
For the second time in 3 weeks, shots were fired at San Diego Gas and Electric's headquarters in Kearny Mesa. The pair of shootings at the headquarters happened on Fridays, once on April 17th and again on May 8th. SDG&E confirmed that on Friday, May 8th, there was a discharge of a firearm into San Diego Gas and Electric's headquarters on Century Park Boulevard. Fortunately, no one was injured. A statement read in part, "We are actively participating with law enforcement on their active investigation and remain focused on the safety of our employees." A source told Fox 5 News each shooting took place in the early morning and the company has beefed up security at the facility. According to San Diego police, there have been 5 shootings within a half mile of the SDG&E business complex since January, including the Courtyard Marriott. In all cases, shots were fired at windows of businesses at night or in the early morning, he said. SDPD has not released information about a possible suspect. No one was injured in either shooting. This is Leon Thompson with the Crime Beat Report on KNSJ.
San Diego supervisors this week approved steps to respond to the state's orders for slashing water use during the drought. Supervisors voted unanimously to reduce irrigation along county roads and medians, install artificial turf at county-run ball fields, retrofit water systems at county facilities, and cut operating hours at the newly built waterfront park fountains. Supervisors also approved plans to install a water reclamation system at the Las Colinas Detention Facility in Santee and to study feasibility of a similar system at a prison in Otay, since prisons account for half the water use at county facilities since the state-ordered prisoner realignment. Supervisors also faulted state regulators for failing to take into account previous conservation efforts. The package of steps approved by supervisors includes continuing to lobby the state to amend the required cutbacks based on previous conservation efforts. The latest county actions are forecast to cost $14.8 million, including $13.2 million in new allocations. Reporting for East County Magazine at KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
If California takes the most aggressive approach to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, it'll be rewarded with 1 million new jobs and a 6% jump in economic growth by 2050. That's according to a new report from UC Berkeley released on Tuesday. The report looks at ways to reach California's ambitious goals to slash greenhouse gases. The study's author, economics professor David Roland Holst, says the state needs to make some big changes.
We have to really restructure the entire transportation and the electric power system in the state, because we just can't continue with the fossil fuel consumption pattern and get the emissions down.
The governor issued an executive order today that sets an interim goal for 2030. Emissions have to be cut by 40% over 1990 levels and then by 80% by 2050. This might be achieved by bumping up the percentage of power we get from renewable energy, requiring that more electric vehicles be produced for the California market, and tightening up the state's cap-and-trade program. Opponents in the oil industry say the new technologies required are too expensive and will cost jobs. But Roland Holst says the potential benefits to society far outweigh the costs.
The idea that there's a trade-off between economic growth and environment is really a fallacy, and California has kind of proven that.
The report was sponsored by the nonprofit group Next 10, which commissions research into clean energy. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A body has been found inside a burned home in Alpine. Detectives from the Alpine Sheriff's Station responded to a radio call reporting a structure fire in the 1400 block of Marshall Road on Tuesday, shortly before 2 p.m. Finding the home fully engulfed in flames, deputies evacuated nearby neighbors and checked surroundings for victims. The Alpine Fire Department arrived and extinguished the fire. During the investigation, the body was found inside the home. The sheriff's bomb arson unit is investigating the blaze. Cause and manner of death of the victim will be determined by an autopsy. Anyone with information on this incident is asked to call the sheriff's non-emergency line at 858-565-5200. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
About 220 miles south of Tecate, near the Pacific Ocean, is the rich agricultural region known as San Quintin. Strawberry fields stretch as far as the eye can see. Tomatoes, blackberries, and raspberries, bound for American grocery stores like Whole Foods and Bonds, are grown in this fertile valley. The work is backbreaking, the weather is scorching, and the workers work from sunup till sundown. They earn around $5 per day, about the cost of a basket of strawberries at Whole Foods. KPFK Radio reports that about 30,000 workers from the San Quintin region earn less than $10 a day and aren't given any benefits. The workers have been fighting for a contract that includes at least $14 a day and basic federal health benefits. Many are subcontract farmers who pay even less than the big industrial growers like Driscoll's, Berrymex, and Sakuma. Farm workers have organized, and attempts to negotiate with growers have been futile. The big growers say they pay more in San Quintin than they do elsewhere in the world and refuse to talk. Doug Porter with the City Beat has done in-depth reporting and has uncovered disturbing facts. The farm workers are protesting working conditions and low wages. They planned a strike as their grievances had not been addressed for months, and some of the workers decided to blockade a tomato farm Sunday morning, asking their colleagues to join them on a picket line until Wednesday, when the Deputy Secretary of the Interior, Luis Enrique Miranda Nava, was to arrive. Many Baja California and Mexican government officials are actually owners or investors in the 12 largest farms, as well as in some of the smaller ones. Former Mexican President Felipe Calderon, for example, is an investor in one of the companies. The near fusion between corporate executives and the Baja California government has made it difficult for workers to achieve even the minimal wages, benefits, and conditions to which they are entitled under the law. This weekend's violence followed the failure of Interior Minister Luis Miranda Nava to show up for a meeting with leaders of farm workers' organizations in the area. Thus, the suffering workers can expect little from the police, government, and law enforcement authorities. Organizers say hundreds of Mexican federal police attacked a mostly peaceful worker rally. The workers allege that police have been carrying out raids on their homes in the neighborhood of Nuevo San Juan Copala without authorization, which resulted in assaults on whole families, including children, according to the website La Jornada, the journal. Mexican authorities say protesters pelted police with rocks and bottles. Officers responded with tear gas and fired numerous rounds of rubber bullets. Reports estimate dozens were injured. Organizers told La Jornada, a Mexican daily, that police infiltrators began instigating the crowds and are mostly to blame for the unrest. Reporters say two cars in a police station were torched. The Mexican army is also patrolling the massive rally, but sources say they did not appear to get involved. This was reportedly followed by the owner of the ranch calling the police, who arrived at 5 a.m. local time and allegedly started raiding workers' homes with no warrants. Thousands of Mexican farm workers from San Quintin, Baja California, just a few miles from our Southern California border, are regrouping right now after a harrowing day of protests and political rallies. Max Correa Hernandez of the Central Campesina Cardenista and Fidel Sanchez Gabriel, spokesman for the Movement of Agricultural Workers of San Quintin, have called upon the state and federal governments to intervene, saying more than 80 people have been injured by police on recent days. The protesters are now asking us, the public, to help by boycotting produce from the region. La Jornada Baja California says union leaders will be issuing an international call on Wednesday for a boycott of fruits and vegetables exported from this region in protest of the violations of human and labor rights suffered by the workers. This has been Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine on the Station for Social Justice, KNSJ.
A big show of force at the Ramona Air Attack Base as government agencies came together to warn San Diego of the potential for large wildfires this season, a natural disaster we are all too familiar with.
First to speak was Tony Meacham with the San Diego County Fire Authority.
San Diego County has a long history of wildland fires. The Mount Laguna Fire of 1970, the Palomar Fire in 1987, the Harmony Fire of 1996, the Pines Fire of 2002, the Cedar Fire in 2003, the Rice, Pumacha, and Harris Fire in 07, and recently, last May, with the Bernardo Fire, the Cocos Fire, and the Poinsettia Fire.
The Forest Service, CAL FIRE, San Diego Sheriffs, even the Navy were all here to illustrate the cooperation that exists to quickly respond to a fire in the region.
Next up was Supervisor Bill Horn.
We're in a drought. Huge drought, and I happen to be a grower who uses water. So we're cutting back on that, and we would just tell everybody else, not only just cutting back, but be observant, be aware. Let us keep putting these fires out at less than 10 acres.
CAL FIRE Chief Ken Pimlott warned of the increasingly difficult conditions facing firefighters.
We are in the fourth year of an unprecedented drought. What this means is statewide, we are seeing vegetation conditions that are drier than they've ever been, and they are creating fire behavior and conditions that fires are burning in that are unprecedented. When fires escape initial attack, we've seen them grow last year as much as 15 miles in one day.
Officials are urging residents to help prepare by creating defensible space around homes and having a disaster plan at the ready. More information can be found at readysandiego.org. In the County News Center, I'm Dominic Fulgoni.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
This is Leon Thompson with East County Magazine, and I'm in the studio with Miriam Raftery, who's a globetrotter and ecotourist who's just returned from Costa Rica and Nicaragua. Why did you decide to go to Costa Rica, of all the places you could have gone on vacation?
Well, my degree is in environmental studies. I'm truly an environmentalist at heart, and I loved the idea of going to a country that has built its economy around ecotourism. While other places in Central America and South America are doing slashing and burning of their rainforests for, you know, making a fast buck off selling timber or nuts or things that grow and can't be replenished and destroying the rainforest, Costa Rica is working to preserve its rainforests. And it was just so beautiful, Leon, to see an intact ecosystem like that, where you go through these beautiful places and there's tropical birds and butterflies and monkeys and, you know, volcanoes.
It was speaking really of volcanoes, I understand there was an eruption while you were there.
Well, there were. Actually, we picked our airport right. We flew into Liberia instead of into San Jose Airport down there, and the San Jose Airport was actually shut down by a volcanic eruption while we were there.
Oh, my.
But we went to the rim, right to the rim of another volcano at Arenal. Costa Rica has many volcanoes, and that's one of the highlights that you can see.
Did you travel into the rainforest?
We did, by several different ways. My husband actually took a whitewater rafting trip through, which, because I have a bad shoulder, I couldn't do. Another day, we went horseback riding up in there, and then you get to the top, and you can zip line down. And again, with my shoulder, I couldn't do it, but he did. And I got to go to the midpoint where they fly you over a 500-foot-tall chasm with this giant waterfall in the rainforest, and I took pictures of everybody else zip lining down. And
flying over the canyon, you say?
Well, when I say flying, I mean zip lining 500 feet up. You're hanging on to that thing and sailing over there. Another day, we took a hike. There's a place down there called Samara Trails, and it was really interesting because this was a family where our tour guide's grandfather owns the land And he's spent 28 years reclaiming the land that used to be, you know, barren for cattle raising, where they had slashed and burned the forest before they acquired it. And he's spent 28 years getting the rainforest to regrow. So it was really encouraging to see that the rainforest can come back again with a little TLC. And he also has a mango grove there. But you go through, and they've dedicated part of their land as an ecological preserve. So you can go through and see these mature rainforest trees. There were howler monkeys every place. You can get photos. He teaches you all the things that you can eat if you're ever lost in the rainforest. We learned all the plants you could eat, and we got to try them all, from, you know, chocolate-type plants to termites they have you sample, and some very bizarre things.
You ate termites?
I ate a termite. I did eat a termite, which is a high-protein source. Didn't taste very good. It's kind of crunchy and nutty. But there's also mangoes.
And you rode horseback while you were down there, too.
I rode horseback. I did do that.
Where did you ride to?
We rode through the rainforest up to the top of the zip line, and then most of the people rode the zip line down, and those of us that couldn't because of physical limitations, they took you down in a truck so you could go see the whole thing and take pictures. We also took a boat ride, and that was interesting too.
Did you see the impact of climate change while you were in Nicaragua and Costa Rica?
I definitely did, Leon. The time that we were traveling was supposed to be the start of the rainy season, and they were all waiting for it. And normally it rains every day this time of year, and it only rained once while we were down there. You could really see areas that were very, very dry and parched. And the major newspaper down there, El Nacion, had an article while we were there, and it was taking the United States Congress to task for not representing the interests of the people, but representing the interests of the oil industry and the fossil fuel industry, even though polls show the American people, by a vast majority, support action on climate change. So that's the kind of publicity that we're getting. They were blaming specifically in the newspaper there the conservatives in Congress for doing this. So even though we have these beautiful tropical rainforests still in many places down there, they are threatened by the United States not taking action on climate change.
So they love Americans, but we're still the ugly Americans when it comes to the environment.
That's definitely true. But the tourists themselves are welcomed in Costa Rica, which makes its living really off of ecotourism.
What was Nicaragua like?
Nicaragua is really a study in contrast. In Nicaragua, you have the very, very wealthy and the very, very poor. So you go through these little villages and you see the poor people out with their donkey carts and ox carts and bicycles, you know, hauling goods to market and things, and really living in very impoverished conditions by American or even by Central American standards. Another place, we took a boat trip out onto a lake, and they had a wildlife preserve out there, so you could see all kinds of tropical birds and some monkeys and things. But there were also these incredible mansions where the very, very wealthy live, and many of them are not from Nicaragua, but they're from the United States and other parts of the world. And you could buy an entire island out there for maybe $200,000. It was just amazing. And some of them with mansion for like $350,000. But it was very troubling to see the poverty. And I know I found myself buying a lot more souvenirs than I really needed, because I just couldn't resist when these cute little boys would come up and they would tell you they're hungry and will you buy my pottery? I made it myself. And you know they probably didn't, but it was beautiful. And I felt like it was important to do our part to help the poor there while I was there.
You know, going back to Costa Rica and the environmental protection there and the contrast with Nicaragua, mm-hmm. What motivated that private property owner to restore his land to tropical jungle? And why is there so much of this ecotourism there? And what have you learned that you can bring back that mm-hmm. we can apply here?
Well, you see this all over Costa Rica, and I really don't know how it got started there and why more countries don't do it. But what you see is a country that has a very thriving economy built around the tourism, and they've managed to preserve their beautiful natural areas and even reclaim some of it. It's brought a lot of jobs by doing that, because everywhere you go when you travel around, you see signs for kayaking and lodging and restaurants and bicycle tours and horseback riding and zip lining and boat rides. And, I mean, you just can't imagine. The whole economy is centered around ecotourism. And we went on something called monkey tours, which is one of many tours you can take down there.
And you go with monkeys on a tour?
Well, you see monkeys all over in the rainforest. But they also take you to these fabulous resorts. It's not third world. And one of them is the biggest hot spring resort in the world.
Oh, tell us about that.
Yeah, the Mount Baldy Resort. And they have these hot springs that are fed by the volcano, and they're all different temperatures, and some of them you swim under waterfalls. That one's more like Disneyland for adults. And there's another one called Puraquín, which is set up actually in the rainforest itself, and it's a very natural setting, and so you're surrounded by trees that have howler monkeys in them, and the iguanas come right up to the porch, and you're really out in the jungle.
Did you feed the iguanas?
I didn't, but some people do, and there's squirrels.
What do iguanas eat?
The last place we stayed was a place called Villa Playa de Samara, the beach at Samara, basically a resort. The mango tree outside our cabana was sort of like party central for iguanas. They would climb up and eat the mangoes and hang out at the bottom and fight with each other over who gets the best mango. And there were minor birds that do the same.
I heard there's 2,800 different varieties of birds in Costa Rica.
You know, it wouldn't surprise me. There are beautiful, colorful birds you see.
Toucans?
Yes, there are toucans. There are parrots. Many others that I'd never even heard of. Different varieties of jays and just bright colored.
Monkeys and squirrels?
Monkeys everywhere. The howler monkeys. And you can go right up near them. And squirrels, they have these red squirrels with big ears that were hanging out, like literally, you didn't have to go far. The place that we were staying at, one of them, they were hanging out in the tree right over our breakfast table there, just waiting to, you know, catch a snack.
But how about a three-toed tree sloth? My favorite animal.
They do have them there. We were not fortunate enough to see that, but my daughter took the same tour last year, which is how we heard about it, and they did see sloths when they did the river rafting trip. So every time you go, it's different. It's an adventure. It was my first time ever actually doing a tour with other people. We've always just traveled with just family. But it was really fun. We had 13 very adventuresome people on our bus. And the biggest kick was there was an older couple there. And this was his bucket list he was doing. He was a cancer survivor. And he was bound and determined to just have the adventure of his life with his wife. They were so cute. So they were doing things like building this giant bonfire on the beach beside their cabana and inviting everybody else to come hang out at the bonfire. And he was taking surfing lessons, and it was just fun. We all went out to dinner together all over the place.
Did you ever feel fear of crime or anything of that nature down there? It was pretty safe and secure while you were there?
I felt very safe in Costa Rica. Nicaragua, they did caution us to keep your belongings close because there are not violent crime really, but pickpockets, you know, is an issue because of the poverty there, that somebody might try to distract you. And if you have a whole bunch of these kids surround you, you know, watch it because one might pick the pocket. So we just kept the wallet on an inside zipper someplace, and it was not a problem. When you go out at night, it's totally safe. We went as a group. The one thing you do have to be careful about in Nicaragua is they tell you not to drink the local water there. It's fine at the resorts. It's fine at the finer restaurants. But the rest of the time, you should bring bottled water just to avoid the traveler health issues that you can worry about.
Is there anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to talk about?
Yes. You know, I've been to Hawaii before, and I will say that the beaches in some ways were even better than Hawaii. Hawaii is great if you're a surfer and you want those 20-foot waves. But at Samara, the water was so warm, it was like bath water, and it was just a beautiful turquoise blue, and you could swim out as far as you wanted. The waves were very small. Apparently, it wasn't always that way. They had a big earthquake just a few years ago, and it changed the configuration of the bay. But the people there also, everybody was very, very friendly. I do speak some Spanish, but even if you didn't, everyone there speaks English. They're all very friendly. They're all very welcoming of Americans. It's not like some parts of the world where you travel and you know, I'm told people don't even want to admit to being American because there's that kind of anti-American sentiment. So even though they don't like our Congress and what they're not doing on global warming, they're able to separate the government from people. And mostly the Americans that go down there for ecotourism tours are pretty environmentally minded and fit in really well. But it's a beautiful place. I would go back. I can really understand why people retire down there. And I will say it was tempting when we went down to the part where you see the islands for sale. They had an island for sale for $150,000. And the guy doing the bucket list said, I'm in for $20,000. Can't the rest of you chip something in? We'll just all come build a big place and retire. And let's not go back. It was tempting.
Well, it's been wonderful talking to you. Miriam Raftery, our editor, doing our very first travel report. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, and it is good to be back.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. The East County Magazine show airs Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Rebecca Williamson.
And Leon Thompson, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week. This week's Destination East County includes classic cars, a wine and food festival, America on Main Street, and a last chance for romance, and more.
Plus, we'll also have a preview of coming attractions, including a fiddler's competition in Julian, a street fair in Santee, and craft beer festival.
So stay tuned for all of these events and much, much more.
The San Diego County Vintners Association Wine and Food Festival will exclusively feature San Diego County wineries, along with educational winemaking and food demonstrations, a silent auction, and live music. Tickets are $50 in advance, $65 at the door, and include unlimited wine tasting and a selection of gourmet foods. This is the one and only fundraising event benefiting the San Diego County wine industry to support educational seminars and marketing for all San Diego County Vintner Association member wineries and vineyards. California winemaking began right here in San Diego County, explained San Diego County Vintners Association President Linda McWilliams, owner of San Pasquale Winery in La Mesa. With more than 100 wineries in our county now, San Diego is fast becoming a premier destination for wine lovers. For more information, go to sandiegowineries.org.
This coming Friday, May 15th, the Lamplighters Community Theater will present Last Chance for Romance from 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. Curtain times are Fridays and Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Sunday matinees at 2 p.m. Last Chance Romance is a comedy in two acts written by American playwright Sam Bowbridge about a strong-willed woman in her late 30s determined to get married at any cost, and the unassuming man in his early 40s is the guy she goes after and gets, much against his will. After several months of married life, Myra realizes that the chase excited her more than the capture and wants out. Leonard, on the other hand, now wants to stay married to her more than anything. The play runs May 15th to June 7th. Founded in June of 1937 as the La Mesa Little Theater and incorporated as the Lamplighters Community Theater on November 1st, 1976, the theater now has had continuous productions in La Mesa for 65 years. Group rates are available for 10 or more. You can purchase tickets online at lamplighterslamesa.com.
Get ready to rev up every Wednesday for Cajon Classic Cruises, which started Wednesday, April 22nd, with a full street closure for opening night. The cruises will continue all summer long on Wednesday nights from 5 until 8 through October 28th. Cajon Classic Cruises continues to draw crowds with hot rods and old-time classic rock music. This Wednesday, May 13th, from 5 p.m. in the cool of the evening and the late afternoon until dark at 8 p.m., you can experience it all from the corner of Main Street and Magnolia in downtown El Cajon, across the street from Promenade Park. There are bands, vendors, and local merchants ready to greet you. Highlights include a military tribute June 17th, Thunder on Main Street September 30th, and the popular Trunk or Treat on October 28th at the season's end. More information, go to downtownelcajon.com.
America on Main Street, a fun-filled family event, is being held this year on Saturday, May 16th, in the downtown El Cajon area, beginning at 8 a.m. and lasting until 8 p.m. Admission is free, as are miniature pony rides, a kid-friendly petting zoo, large Ferris wheel, and varieties of games and crafts for the children. There will also be four different stages featuring live entertainment and music for your listening pleasure. For details, visit americamainstreet.org.
Explore Mission Trails Day will be held this Saturday, May 16th, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Mission Trails Regional Park. This free event features free guided nature walks, talks, and programs throughout the park, including live animals and special kids programs from pony rides to a climbing wall, as well as a program in the amphitheater featuring coyotes. There will also be a bicycle demonstration and a program in the amphitheater. For details, see mtrp.org.
All that and more is happening this weekend, but mark your calendars for these coming attractions.
The Santee Street Fair and Craft Beer Festival, organized by Santee's Chamber of Commerce, will be held on Saturday, May 23rd from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. This large festival features local breweries from around San Diego County, live music and entertainment, a crafter row and artist gallery, over 300 food and vendor booths, carnival rides and games for the family. In celebration of the Memorial Day weekend, there will also be a tribute to the veterans. Admission is free, though there is a fee for beer tasting. The location is at the junction of Riverview Parkway and Town Center Parkway. For details, visit SanteeStreetFair.com.
Julian hosts its Arts and Crafts Fair on Saturday, May 23rd, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., organized by the Julian Fireplugs. The event benefits the Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District and will be held at 2033 Main Street in Julian.
Also in Julian, the California State Old Time Fiddlers Association District 7 presents the Julian Fiddle and Pickin' Contest on Saturday, May 30th at Julian's Town Hall in the historic gold mining town of Julian. Building on the decades-long history of the former Julian Banjo and Fiddle Contest, the Julian Fiddle and Pickin' Contest provides fiddlers, guitarists, mandolin players, and banjo players an opportunity to demonstrate their talents in a festive and friendly atmosphere. For details, visit sandiegofiddler.org. That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
The price of cigarettes could go up by $2 a pack if two new ballot initiatives are approved next year. The Save Lives California Coalition just filed papers with the state attorney general to ask voters to hike taxes on traditional tobacco products and on e-cigarettes in 2016. They estimate it'd raise $1.5 billion in the first year, money that would be used to expand access to Medi-Cal, fund research into smoking-related diseases, and improve anti-smoking efforts. Kimberly Amazine from the American Lung Association California says tobacco companies spent heavily to defeat similar ballot measures in 2006 and 2012.
California has not increased its tobacco tax since 1998. We're currently at 87 cents per pack, which ranks 33rd in the nation for tobacco taxes.
Supporters are also going the legislative route, pushing for several similar bills currently under consideration in Sacramento. The Save Lives California Coalition includes, among others, the American Heart Association, the American Lung Association, the American Cancer Society, and the California Medical Association. Opponents say tobacco taxes disproportionately affect low-income residents. Amazine says raising the price encourages people to make better choices.
Increasing the cost of tobacco is widely recognized as the most effective way to reduce smoking across California, especially with our young people. Just by raising the tax alone, it will keep kids today from trying their first cigarette.
Supporters claim that over the past 20 years, anti-smoking programs have prevented 1 million deaths and saved taxpayers $134 billion in health care costs. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
An Army veteran who saved a dog from a hot Mustang has been arrested for smashing a window to free the animal. Multiple news outlets report that Michael Hammond of Athens was charged with criminal trespassing after freeing a small Pomeranian mix in distress from a hot car outside a store. Witnesses say that while a group of shoppers waited for police to arrive to free the dog, the Army veteran smashed the window. Deputies say the car's owner insisted Hammonds be arrested. Deputies did not identify the woman. She was cited for leaving the dog in the hot car. Georgia state law allows an individual to break a window to save a child in distress, but not a pet. Animal advocates say they are working to change the law. For East County Magazine, this is Leon Thompson.
About a million animals are killed on America's roads every day, pushing some species to the brink of extinction. The roadkill problem is particularly acute in California's national forests and parks, including Yosemite, where conservationists are building special tunnels for wildlife to cross roads safely. Humans have to know where to build the tunnels, so Fraser Schilling, co-director of the Road Ecology Center at UC Davis, is asking the public to report roadkill on the website wildlifecrossing.net.
It's open to anybody to participate in and helps us to understand where there are conflicts between wildlife and vehicles and possibly what we can do about it.
The California Roadkill Observation System also helps biologists track animal movements. One species, a medium-sized carnivore called a fisher, is estimated to have only 300 adults left in the Southern Sierra population. Pamela Flick with Defenders of Wildlife says the fisher is now a candidate to be listed as an endangered species on the West Coast.
The amount of fishers being hit by cars in the southern Yosemite area could actually be causing a decline in the species.
Sandra Jacobson with the U.S. Forest Service says roadkill isn't just a problem for the animals.
Usually about 200 people per year are killed in animal vehicle collisions in the U.S., and there is literally billions of dollars in other costs, including human injuries and then property damage.
Some of the other wild animals most often killed on California roads include the black bear, mule deer, and great gray owl. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities.
San Diego Gas and Electric Company has presented a check for over $1.2 million to the Pala Band of Mission Indians and Pala Casino Spa and Resort for installing energy-efficient equipment. The loan is the largest ever funded through SDG&E's on-bill financing and energy efficiency business rebates and incentives programs. SDG&E estimates that the improvements will save Pala nearly $250,000 in electric costs every year. The loan period will last just over 4 years, and funds will be repaid from the energy cost savings produced by the equipment. Government-funded customers such as Pala are eligible to finance projects that meet the payback period of up to 10 years. Given the project size, it is estimated that it will be paid back in less than 3.5 years. On-bill financing has helped over 1,400 non-residential customers since the utility pioneered the program back in 2007. Over $46 million in energy efficiency equipment has been financed through the program, which lends funds to commercial, non-residential customers in good standing with the utility to purchase qualifying equipment with no money down and no interest payments. To learn more about on-bill financing, visit sdge.com/BUSIN. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
State Senator Joel Anderson will be listening to constituents and inviting ideas to improve state government at a community coffee on Thursday, May 28th, starting at 6 p.m. at Santee City Hall. The free event, open to the public, will be hosted by Santee Mayor Randy Vopel. Anderson says that about 40% to 60% of the bills he introduces every year originate as ideas from people in his district. His 38th state Senate district includes Poway, Santee, El Cajon, La Mesa, and most of the unincorporated areas in East County. Senator Anderson is also a candidate running for county supervisor. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing La Mesa Police Captain Dan Willis, author of Bulletproof Spirit, the first responder's essential resource for protecting and healing mind and heart. My guest, who is a homicide investigator and former SWAT commander, has developed a wellness program providing emotional survival to first responders. Much needed. Welcome, Captain Willis. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here.
Let's start with your 25 years of service in East County. What have you experienced and witnessed about how emotional trauma affects first responders? And I know that includes police officers, firefighters, EMTs, emergency room personnel, and soldiers. What I'm asking is, what provoked you to write this book?
Well, over my 26 years, I've seen not only within myself, but in so many of my colleagues, how the adverse effects of the job of being immersed in heartache all the time, seeing so much violence and death and suffering, how that really does take a tremendous emotional toll on those who serve. And often it's very toxic and debilitating to their spirit. And it can lead to depression, to substance abuse, burnout and cynicism. Far more than half the people who start a first responder profession never finish to full retirement.
Really?
So there really is a disheartening status of how well our first responders are doing, because a lot of them are really suffering and need help.
Now, what's the symptom that you see the most often in your own staff?
There's several. For me personally, it was becoming what I call emotionally dead. Mm-hmm. I noticed after about 7 or 8 years on that I really didn't have any feelings anymore. I wasn't happy. I wasn't sad. I didn't feel connected to anybody or anything. I didn't feel engaged with my wife and stepkids. Just very numb inside. And looking back on it, that was a way to try to survive in the midst of heartache and dealing with people's tragedies. Unfortunately, that obviously plays havoc with your personal relationships.
Right.
And that was kind of a wake-up call of, this isn't normal. This isn't right. And I really need to look at myself, become more self-aware of how the job's adversely affecting me, and do something proactive about it.
Right. And is that also what you see in your staff, people working with you?
That's a very common one, is this emotional numbing. But another very significant symptom is sleep disorders. Most first responders get about 4 hours of sleep, maybe 5 on average, and people really need 8 or 9 to be able to function normally, to process stress and to feel and be well. And if you're getting 4 or 5 hours of sleep day in, day out, on top of dealing with the acute stress and the trauma of the job, I mean, that's going to have a significant impact on your quality of life and your overall wellness. Yeah, another sign that I see is anger, that people tend to get angry at the smallest of things, things that would never bother them before. And that's just a sign, another sign, that they're not processing stress in a positive, constructive manner.
So that really brings us to talking about the official diagnosis of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And I know that the symptoms that you've named are connected to that. But what do you think that the public needs to know about PTSD?
The public, I think, really needs to understand that there's approximately 120,000 police officers in America who are going to work every single day with full symptoms of PTSD, and many of them not really realizing what they have. And the symptoms go far beyond what we were just talking about, that they are acute panic attacks, nightmares, reliving trauma that they've experienced over and over and over again. It becomes very, very debilitating. So PTSD is really a byproduct of all the negative things that we see when we don't train our first responders how to protect, heal, and nurture their spirit. And there are really some effective treatments for PTSD out there. And writing the book was just a way of trying to get, in part, that message out, that we really need to look for help and go ask for it. That PTSD is not a weakness. It's really not about what's wrong with you. It's all about what happened to you. And it really is an injury to your brain's ability to process a traumatic event. And there are therapies that will help your brain heal and put that event in its proper perspective so you can move on without the memories being crippling.
Well, it sounds like another main point is that the event doesn't have to have happened directly to you. You can experience vicarious trauma by witnessing it.
Oh, very much so. Not only just witnessing it from our brother, sister, officer, but often we suffer with our victims as well. I mean, if you spend 5, 7, 8 hours with a traumatized sexual assault victim who was brutally raped, how do you go home and be a happy, engaged father, mother, or spouse? I mean, you really can't. And the ways that we try to deal with it without any proper training is often substance abuse, isolating ourselves from our family so we can just kind of deal with it on our own. And these things are really self-destructive and aren't helpful at all.
Right. Okay, well, let's go to your book. What are some of the main lessons or strategies described in Bulletproof Spirit? Without giving a spoiler, can you explain to us what kinds of strategies you suggest and promote?
Well, the first and probably the most critical principle is to learn to become more self-aware. When I go around teaching emotional survival to first responder agencies, I always ask them, now raise your hand if the job has negatively affected you, affected your health and wellness, your view on people and life, and your quality of your life. And every single person always raises their hand immediately. So if the job is adversely affecting us very negatively, there's got to be something that we can do on the proactive side that will help counteract some of that. But if we're not aware, because a lot of these negative aspects are very slow, they're very insidious as far as how they affect us. I like to call it, it's like a cancer of the spirit. Mm-hmm. And before you know it, over time, you've become someone that your loved ones no longer recognize. And at that point, often it's too late. So I like to tell people to engage their loved ones, solicit feedback, ask them, how is the job changing me? How am I different? And if you see me not being myself, please come to me and ask me what's going on and give me that information so I can do something about it before it is too late.
And do you suggest any strategies for the doing something about it?
The book itself has over 40 wellness strategies and emotional survival methods. Basically, it's up to the individual officer to take information such as in Bulletproof Spirit and find what works for them. And I've done all 40 that I describe in the book. Some are more effective than others. But the main thing is to find things that are going to be life-affirming for you throughout your career, because a career can be life-depleting. Right. So often first responders stop doing the things they loved before they became a cop.
Oh, that's a good example.
So you got to keep the friends that you had outside of the agency. Do those things that you loved. For me, it was being in nature, bike riding, hiking, going to national parks. I love swimming in the ocean. Mm-hmm. A lot of those things I kind of stopped doing when I first became a cop. And when you start doing those things again and be active and force yourself to be engaged in your personal life and with the people that are your lifeline of support, you can weather a lot of the storms of the spirit that you're going to face.
Well, that leads us to your training program, which is on emotional survival and wellness. And you've described strategies for getting there and for staying well mentally and physically, because I know the two are connected. Where has the gap been traditionally in these areas? What kind of training do you believe first responders usually receive, and where is it lacking?
Well, that's a great question, because traditionally, the only training first responders receive is for your mind and the body. You know, they teach you about the laws and how to handle certain instances and procedures, and they will tell you to be physically fit, but they have always neglected the most important part of us, which is our spirit. And our spirit, I like to define as everything that's not of our mind and our body. It's what helps us to process stress, to overcome trauma, and to want to serve with compassion. It's our resiliency to acute stress. It's our motivation and inspiration to want to devote ourselves to a life of public service. And our spirit is really the foundation of our mental health, our physical health, our emotional health. And if we neglect the spirit, then we're neglecting our overall health and well-being. So the emphasis of the book, which I hope will become more and more part of the curriculum in training first responders, is to teach them to nurture and to protect their spirit, because the spirit is really going to keep their mind and their body and their emotions well. So the emphasis is more on those things that are life-affirming, which brings life into your spirit, which brings joy back into your life, which helps renew your mind, your emotions, and your inspiration and motivation to keep wanting to serve year in and year out.
I know that you are going to retire soon.
Yes.
From being a La Mesa police captain. Are you planning to train first responders yourself as you move through your retirement?
Oh, definitely. In fact, for the past 10 years, I've been an instructor at the San Diego Police Academy.
Mm-hmm.
And with the publication of the book that just came out a few weeks ago, I've already been booked to teach in Kansas regarding emotional survival and the strategies that are in the book. So I hope as the word gets out, I'll be asked to travel around the country and present training seminars to help get the word out about the essential and critical need to offer that kind of training to protect and heal the spirit.
What feedback have you gotten from the people who have received your training?
Pretty much universally, I hear, I really wish I had this kind of information when I started my career. So, I mean, people really do know how negative and harmful the job can be, but we've never really had anything to help us through it.
Right.
So now, hopefully this is, and our first responders will find this very, very useful and meaningful to them.
It sounds like you're doing a really much-needed project.
Oh, thank you.
One last question. Is there another book in the wings, or are you going to focus on promoting what you've already written?
There's not really another book right now. I really want to devote myself, now that I'm at the end of my career,
mm-hmm.
to helping to protect and help those who are going to be coming after me. I mean, we all depend on first responders for our life and well-being. And so often the general public just really doesn't understand how much they're suffering in their service. I mean, they're the only ones that protect and give life to people. And often it's their own life, their own emotional.
Sacrifice.
Absolutely.
Right.
So I really want to continue my devotion to helping those I've served with and those following me to teach them what I've learned through trial and error, mostly error, mm-hmm. but what has really worked not only with me, but what I've seen with other first responders. So hopefully they'll make it to a full retirement, be prideful about the service they've been able to do throughout their adult life, and be happy that they were able to affect so many people for the good and in a positive way and be happy and healthy themselves.
Would you like to finish with a word of hope for the first responders themselves, if they happen to be listening?
Well, the book offers a tremendous message of hope, a very positive message that you don't have to be victims of your career. I mean, so often it seems like first responders kind of hope for the best. They get involved in a fatal shooting, a critical incident happens, and the agency is kind of there for the first week or so, and then it's not talked about, and everyone just kind of quietly, gee, I hope that person gets over it. I hope they're okay. We can't just hope anymore. Suicide is the number one cause of death for police officers every single year in the United States. Nearly 200 kill themselves. And we can't just hope for the best and lose so many devoted heroes. It's a senseless shame, especially when there's information that can really help them.
Okay, so the information is out there. They just have to find it, and they can do that through your book.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, our time is up. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
If you would like more information on Captain Dan Willis and Bulletproof Spirit, please visit firstresponderwellness.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Kevin McLeod, Corey Clement. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.